Okay, we got up to slide 8 last time, and in 8 we're looking at yet another cross. It starts out pretty much like things we've talked about. This is a dihybrid cross, so there are two characteristics. What are the characteristics here? Body color and wing shape, yes. And it's just like you'd expect for a dihybrid cross, the parents differ in the traits for each of the two characteristics. So this one is gray color instead of black, and gray is dominant over black. And she has full normal wings, which is dominant over vestigial wings. The other has black body, recessive, and vestigial wings, very, very much reduced in size. Okay, so that's really can be you can see from the genotypes, which once again uses the initial for the recessive rather than for the dominant. And if you have a plus, then that means it's not the recessive version; it's the wild type. So B plus, B stands for black, but B plus really means gray, right? And VG stands for vestigial, but VG plus really means normal wings. Anyway, when you look at the genotypes, you can see that not only is this one doubly dominant, dominant in color and dominant in wing shape, but true breeding. In other words, homozygous dominant. The other one, of course, is doubly homozygous recessive, which you would expect by just seeing the traits. And also, as we've seen in other crosses, when those two are crossed, every one of the F1s that result, as you would expect, are doubly heterozygous. B plus B, VG plus VG, right? Now, because of dominance, every one of those F1s is going to look like the true breeding double dominant parent, but they're all heterozygous. Nothing new there. At this point, you would expect to cross F1 with F1 to produce F2. That's what we've been doing, right? That's where it's different here. So we take an F1, and in this specific case, it's a female. It wouldn't have to be, though, because this is none of these is sex-linked characteristic. So it just happens to be a female. And instead of crossing it with a male F1, it's crossed with a male doubly homozygous recessive, just like the original one of the original parents. Just like in the test cross I described before when I introduced the word test cross to you, right? In a test cross, you take a dominant individual, cross it with a recessive individual to find things out. We're doing it for a different reason here, but that's exactly what's happening. Doubly dominant individual crossed with a doubly recessive individual. Now, the only reason sexes are shown here is so that you can match up the gametes. This would have worked exactly the same way if the male had been the gray full-winged and the female the black vestigial wing in the test cross. But since this black vestigial wing one happens to be the male, he's going to make sperm, and you can see that only one type of sperm is listed here. That shouldn't surprise you either, right? Because he's doubly homozygous recessive. He has to choose a B and a VG, and that's it. Only possibility. So that's why it's only one row in the Punnett square. You could make it four, but they would be four identical rows. On the other hand, since she, being an F1, is doubly heterozygous, she can make all four different kinds of eggs here, because you choose one of the two Bs, you choose one of the two VGs, and there's four ways of doing that, right? B plus VG plus, B plus VG, B VG plus, and B VG. That's what meiosis does randomly. So she's able to make four eggs, and that's the only reason sex matters, is to show you that it's this one making the multiple gametes, and it's this one making the single kind of gamete. That leads to the four possible phenotypes combinations for the zygotes, right? And what do we call these first two as a category? How are these first two distinct as a category compared to these last two? No, that these are not doubly, these are not both doubly homozygous. This one's doubly heterozygous, this one's doubly homozygous recessive. So that's not what's different about them as categories. What's true of these first two is that each of them is exactly like one of the original, I mean one of the parents in the cross. So those are called parental types. Right, this one's just like this parent, this one's just like this parent, so they're called parental types. The other two, on the other hand, neither of them is like either parent. Instead, each of them has the color of one parent and the wings of the other parent. So those are called recombinant types. The two categories are parental types and recombinant types, because their traits have been recombined. Okay, well, below that, below the Punnett square, you can see some ratios that correspond to predictions that themselves correspond to hypotheses. There's two hypotheses being tested here, which is why this test cross is being done. And the two hypotheses, as you see, are, as you can gather from the predictions, predictions correspond, spring from hypotheses, right? The first hypothesis is that the two genes here, the color gene and the wing shape gene, are on different chromosomes. And the other hypothesis is that the two genes are on the same chromosome. Now, there's one of those is definitely true, right? There's no other possibility. If they are, well, let me pause here and give you another definition. Any two genes that are on the same chromosome are called linked genes. And be careful with this. Don't confuse linked with sex-linked, which we've already discussed. Sex-linked, recall, is a term that's applied to a single gene. It makes sense for one gene to be called sex-linked. And a gene is sex-linked if and only if it is on a sex chromosome. That's the only thing that sex-linked means. Each individual gene is either sex-linked or not. And if it's not, then it's autosomal. Because if it's not on a sex chromosome, it's on an autosome. On the other hand, it does not make any sense to call a single gene linked. To use the word linked by itself, you have to be considering at least two genes. Right? Every gene, of course, is on a chromosome. But if two genes are on the same chromosome, then we call them linked. Or it could be three genes that are linked and so on. But it has to be more than one. Now, if the two genes in question here, the color gene and the wing shape gene, are on different chromosomes, then they can travel to different places, right? In meiosis. And therefore, you should expect all four possible combinations of phenotypes. All four of these shown in this Punnett square. If they are on different genes. In other words, if the two genes are unlinked. And that's why the predicted phenotypic ratio for the hypothesis that they are not linked is 1:1:1:1. You should expect all four to occur. And you expect them to occur in equal frequencies. It's just as likely for any of the four. So for however many offspring you have, it should be equally divided among those four. On the other hand, if the two genes are linked, then they travel together in meiosis. Because think about what happens in meiosis. It's not individual genes that move around in meiosis. It's chromosomes, right? They get separated and go to different cells. But each chromosome is carrying a bunch of genes. So the genes are like passengers on a bus, basically. They don't go their separate ways. They go wherever the bus goes. And therefore, if the body color gene and the wing shape gene are on the same chromosome, then you'd expect those alleles to go together to one place or the other. And therefore, you would not expect there to be any possibility of recombinant types. Right? And that's why the predicted ratio for the other hypothesis, the hypothesis that they are linked, is 1 to 1 to 0 to 0. You shouldn't expect any recombinant types. You should expect equal numbers of only parentals. Does that all make sense? Just based on these definitions and what your knowledge of meiosis? Okay, well, let's look at the actual results. Remember, these one of these hypotheses has to be correct. There's no other possibility. They're either linked or they're not linked. But when you look at the results, neither prediction came true. You do have all four phenotypes or phenotypic combinations, but it's not even close to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1, right? So what is happening here? Well, the fact that you don't get 1 to 1 to 1 to 1, which should definitely occur if they're not linked, means that they must not be linked. But the fact that there are some recombinants means something else must be going on. How is it that two genes that are linked and therefore are on the same chromosome can suddenly be on different chromosomes? What can cause that to happen?
Can I take a guess from the homework last night?
Well, I'm not going to hit you if you get it wrong.
Something linkage? Or no?
Not linkage, no. It says nothing to do with sex linkedness. Or sex linkage. It's a totally different thing. Remember that Punnett square is a list of all possible zygotes, right? How do you make zygotes? By fusing gametes. What produces gametes? What process? Okay, now what can happen in meiosis to cause two genes that are on the same chromosome to suddenly be on different chromosomes?
Crossing over,
exactly. Crossing over explains these results. Color and, well, in this case specifically, gray, the gray allele and the full wing allele, which were originally on the same chromosome, can be on different chromosomes if crossing over happens the right way to split them apart. All right, now let's look at that in the next slide, slide 9. It's the same exact cross, but now we're looking at the chromosomes to figure this out. This is not the P generation, this is that test cross. So this is an F1 and the test cross double recessive that's it's mated to. He is the double recessive, and since he is true breeding, homozygous recessive for both, the details of meiosis aren't really shown because it doesn't matter, right? There's only one possible sperm he can make. So let's skip the details here. She, though, being an F1, is doubly heterozygous. And so the details of meiosis 1 and 2 are shown, and remember, meiosis 1 is where crossing over occurs, and we're looking at only one chromosome here, because the two genes are linked, so there's only one chromosome involved. All the other chromosomes in the fly are just being ignored because they have nothing to do with this experiment. There are two chromosomes, though, of the same type because she's diploid. But it's one type of chromosome we're looking at here. Is that clear? Well, you can see the two gene loci. One for B, that's the color gene. One for VG, that's the wing shape gene. They're on the same chromosome, so by definition, they are linked. She's heterozygous, though. So one of her chromosomes has the two dominant versions together. The other chromosome has the two recessive versions together. Because of crossing over, though, they separate. They're now on different chromosomes. And that's why you can now have a recessive color and a dominant wing, and on the other one, a dominant color and a recessive wing. But it's not sufficient. It's not merely sufficient, or it's not sufficient merely for crossing over to occur. Not only does crossing over have to occur, it has to occur in the right place. Remember, the position of crossing over is called the chiasm. Well, if the chiasm is anywhere outside of these two, either on this side or on that side, the crossing over wouldn't matter at all, right, to these two genes. They would still be together. You see what I'm saying there? Is that clear to you, or do you want me to draw a picture of that? All right. So let's just use red for one. That's the centromere. And green for the other. So we have two replicated chromosomes, right? And let's just say that the two loci are there. Yeah, those are the two genes. If crossing over occurs anywhere but between them, let's say it occurs right here, they're still good. Those two genes are still going to be together, right? Those two versions, allele versions. It's like crossing over hasn't occurred. Same way down here. But if it occurs in between, then you have this, right? Now they're on different chromosomes. So you not only have to have crossing over occur, you have to have it happen between the two gene loci for them to go different directions and therefore for recombinants to be produced in the offspring. Did you follow all that? Okay. Well, that's exactly what happened. And if you look at the bottom of this, you see a calculation called the recombination frequency. This is defined simply as the total number of recombinants, which is 391 in this case, 206 plus 185, divided by the total number of offspring, which is all four of these added together. That's where the 2300 comes from. And then times 100 just to make it a percentage. So in this particular cross, there was a 17% occurrence of recombinant types. Now, if you have unlinked genes, you're going to get a 50% recombination frequency, right? Because all four possibilities are equally likely. This is below 50%. And what is it that actually determines whether this is a higher than 17 or lower, or a low number or a high number? It's the closeness of the two linked genes, right? The closer they are together, the more unlikely it is that the chiasm is going to occur between the two. And so they'll stay together, and that will prevent recombination. If they were linked, technically linked, because they're on the same gene, but on total opposite ends, then they would act just like they're not linked, because every crossing over event would separate them. So nowadays it's routine that we could just go in and look at actual DNA sequences and see where genes are. When we've mapped many organisms, their entire genome, including humans. But back before any of that was possible, and which wasn't all that long ago, a grad student recognized that these recombination frequencies can be used to map the positions of genes that are on that are known to be linked on the same chromosome. Because it's valuable to know where the genes are for various reasons. Well, this was done before you could actually go in there and sequence the DNA and see them. You can see this in slide 10 as a simple example. There's three genes that are linked here. They're all on the same chromosome, along with other genes, of course. But if you know these three are linked, you can actually do three different crosses, just like the cross we just went through. The one we just went through involves two of these three genes, the B gene and the VG gene. CN gene is an eye color gene. That's also on the same chromosome. So you could do three different crosses, one involving B and CN, and you could calculate by looking at those offspring that it's 9% recombination frequency. CN and VG, 9.5%. And B and VG, 17%, like we saw. So it just means that this greater frequency for recombination involving B and VG compared to the other combinations means that they must be farther apart. So CN is in the middle of the two. It gives you a relative ordering of them on the chromosome. And as we can see in 11, you can just keep adding more and more chromosomes. It's a hell of a lot of work. And like I said, we wouldn't do this anymore nowadays because we can sequence it. But this is all done without ever looking at a molecule. This is just based on offspring. Even though it's kind of outdated in terms of actually going through with it, though, it's helpful in understanding what goes on in meiosis. Hopefully you remember what ploidy is. Well, there's a related word that has ploidy in it, which is euploidy for a noun, or an adjective would be euploid. Remember, EU, just like in eukaryote, means good or true. A euploid cell, or a cell is said to be euploid if it has the normal number of chromosomes for that species and cell type. So, for instance, for humans, a gamete is euploid if it has 23 chromosomes. A somatic cell is euploid if it has 46 chromosomes. Anything other than the normal number, whatever that number is for the species, is aneuploid. AN simply means no or not. I mean, and aneuploidy is a type of mutation, right? Because it affects the DNA. But aneuploidy can happen either because there is too many chromosomes, or there are too few compared to what's normal. So it's a mistake. Aneuploidy is a mistake. Meiosis, which we've studied, usually happens correctly. It has a really impressively low error rate, but not a zero error rate. So mistakes do happen. And meiosis, remember, features two division events. Well, it's during these division events that mistakes can happen, and it can happen in either one of the division events. Before talking about the errors, though, let's say what happened. Let me give you a term that refers to what's supposed to happen and what normally does happen, which is disjunction. Disjunction is the noun form of the verb disjoin, which simply means to separate, right? So disjunction is the normal thing in meiosis. Of course, what disjoins is different in meiosis 1 compared to meiosis 2. What disjoins in meiosis 1? The homologs of a tetrad, exactly. Tetrad splits, the homologs disjoin. What about meiosis two? Right. The sister chromatids of a replicated chromosome separate or disjoint. Okay, so if in the, on the left here we have non-disjunction, which is the error. If the things do not separate properly, then that's called non-disjunction. And on the left example, non-disjunction is occurring in meiosis one. Anaphase is when the separation is supposed to occur, right? So during anaphase, this one tetrad, the top tetrad disjoins normally, but the bottom tetrad doesn't. And therefore, one of the two cells that it splits into gets the full tetrad, and the other one gets nothing for that chromosome. So notice that immediately, these two cells are already aneuploid, both of them. One has too many chromosomes compared to normal, one has too few. Both of those situations cause problems. Which do you think is the more severe problem? The one that is short some chromosomes, right? Because that means none of those genes, which could be thousands of genes, are present in the cell. So, effectively, impossible to survive that. But it's also problematic having more chromosomes than you need it for various reasons. Well, in this case, these already aneuploid cells then undergo meiosis II, in a sense normally, meaning no additional errors occur, but since they were already aneuploid, all four of the resulting gametes are aneuploid. On the other hand, on the right, you have a cell that undergoes normal meiosis I to form these two cells. One of those two cells undergoes normal meiosis II, and you have two normal gametes. The other one, though, undergoes non-disjunction in meiosis II, so these two gametes are both aneuploid. And the reason that this can be a big deal is because we're making gametes in meiosis, right? Which get passed on to the next generation. So it can affect, this affects the offspring, in other words. Any questions on that? Okay, let's continue talking a little bit about mutations, which is, this non-disjunction is a form of mutation. And we talked about mutations already, but when we first started talking about mutations a few chapters back, we studied point mutations, right, which are really small-scale mutations because they involve either one nucleotide pair, just a single letter, or a very few number of nucleotides. In other words, just a fraction of a gene, if it occurs in a gene, is what a point mutation is. Well, there's also very large-scale mutations at the level of the entire chromosome, and those are called, fittingly enough, chromosomal mutations. These chromosomes feature these letters. Those letters do not represent genes. There could be several genes within each lettered region. The letters simply represent regions so you can understand the difference between the types of mutation. The first example is deletion, which means removal, right? So in this case, the D region gets removed. You go from ABCDE to ABCE. And therefore, any genes that are in that D region are missing. So that's going to probably be a big deal, right? Chromosomal mutations have much farther reaching consequences than point mutations. Duplication, as the name indicates, means that a region gets copied. So instead of ABCD, you have ABC, BC again, and then D. So here you've added material. Now this one is definitely more survivable because you still have the normal genes in BC, right? And you have extra copies of whatever genes are in BC now, which can actually be, assuming that this doesn't interfere with the control of B, the genes in B and C normally, these extra copies can actually be beneficial in a sense because it's like an extra copy that you can play around with. Evolution can actually work on these other genes And if something goes wrong, no big deal, you have the original ones. But if they keep getting mutated kind of like as tests, they could actually mutate into something that's even better. That's duplication. Inversion refers to flipping around. So A, B, C, D, E becomes A, D, C, B, E. This doesn't add or subtract any material, so the genes are still there. At least the ones that are in the mid part, like everything in C, is still there, right? There could, the cut, though, between A and B and D and E, where it gets cut and then flipped around, that could occur right in the middle of a gene, which would destroy that gene. But even the genes that aren't actually cut, just the fact that they're now in a different position with respect to the overall chromosome, and you don't learn this in this course, but you would in cell biology, for instance, that means that they might be harder to control, to turn on or off. It's not appropriate to turn on a gene unless it's supposed to be turned on, right? Well, some genes turn into so-called constitutive genes, and you don't have to know that word, which means they're just always turned on, always producing whatever protein they code for, which can cause problems. The most complicated of these is shown on the bottom, reciprocal translocation. This involves two separate chromosomes, normal to begin with, but each of them loses a region that gets swapped with the other. So it's kind of like crossing over, only totally different in how it works, and it's not normal either. Crossing over is normal. So this ends up creating two abnormal chromosomes, which of course can be problematic. And 14 is simply an example of reciprocal translocation. It happens with fairly high frequency in humans, involving chromosome 9 and 22. The swap creates an abnormal version of 22 that's called the Philadelphia chromosome. And this is one way in which leukemia can develop. It's associated with a type of leukemia. But there's other ways leukemia can develop, but this is one way. Otherwise, though, it's just an example of reciprocal translocation. 15 is the last slide, and I'm going to skip it, which means we're done. So you now know everything there is to know about biology at the cellular level, which you'll demonstrate to me by getting 100 on Tuesday.
Might work. Yeah, I know everything. Do you just want to be here right now? Yeah, I'll take that.
I didn't bring him with me, sorry.
Aw, that's you left.
So, any questions before I turn off the recorder? Yeah.
So this exam is obviously...
Yeah, it's not comprehensive. It's just exam 5. Unit 5. Anything else? All right, turn her off.